Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Max. And our special guest today, former co-host of the hit role-playing discussion stream, Dan Collins.
Hey everybody, glad I could make it.
Welcome, Dan.
So, yes, thanks for having me, you guys.
So to catch everyone up, what's going on here is Dan has been dealing with some personal matters recently, and I've been expecting to run the stream without him for some period of time. Was unclear how long, and so I was totally prepared to run the stream today with special co-host Max, my brother Max, who you may recognize from 10 Dead Rats. Thank you, Max, for filling in.
No problem.
And then at the last minute, Dan was available anyway. So we thought, what the heck? Let's invite him in as special guest. So thank you for joining us, Dan.
It's thanks for having me. It's been a crazy week here in Brooklyn, New York, in a whole lot of ways. And I thank you guys for stepping up and supporting me this week and everybody else that supported me. Yeah. So it was up until a couple hours ago. I didn't think I was going to be available. And things got better, which is good, here. So, and the other thing, I have to give a big thanks out to Professor Landon Schwartz of Tulsa Community College, that we thought was going to be our guest this Sunday. And again, since I wasn't really available to prepare and I didn't think I was going to be able to participate, he graciously accepted my suggestion that we reschedule him in about 2 months' time. So Landon Schwartz will be available in about 2 months to talk about philosophy of gaming and aesthetics and things like that. So I'm still looking forward to that. And thank you, Landon, for rescheduling to help me out. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much, Landon. That helps us a lot. I'll also point out that throughout the month of June, we are officially supporting the Bale Project. So this is, you can see the banner at the top of our screen. We're doing a little fundraiser for it. Our goal is $500. We made it to $100 over on Thursday on 10 Dead Rats. I guess if folks will humor me for 2 minutes, I'll just quickly talk about what is the Bale Project. I'm going to read you a quick excerpt from their vision. It says here on their vision page, people in pretrial detention now make up more than two-thirds of America's jail population. They are presumed innocent under the law, yet they will suffer the harms of incarceration unless they have enough money to pay bail and buy their freedom. This two-tier system criminalizes poverty and is a structural linchpin of mass incarceration and racial inequality. It affects entire communities, devastates families for generations, and guts the presumption of innocence. So, I started following this project via Cipher of Tears stream. She's a great streamer, really enjoy her stuff. She also was going to do a quick $500 fundraiser for them. It exploded. Last I checked, she's close to $300,000. Which is, yeah, it's just phenomenal.
Holy moly. Good for her.
So
that's amazing.
You know, we talked a lot about what we could do to help support. And frankly, we love doing the show. That's part of our sort of emotional support during this time. So rather than just advise you to go off to her stream, which you still should do, it's a great stream. We thought we would likewise, in her name, put up our own little fundraiser with a symbolic $500 goal. Maybe we'll reach that. We'll see.
You did pretty good.
Yeah,
that's great.
So, you're probably wondering.
Let me just say. I think Paul set this up. I'm so glad he did. I think that's a great cause. That's an issue that's come up. I live in New York State. That's an issue that's been an important thing recently. We don't do so well about that here in New York State, honestly. And, you know, for a little perspective, you know, here we're obviously all white guys in America. I don't know if you've noticed that. For a little perspective, you know, cash bail is actually not legal in the majority of countries in the world. That's actually a thing that we're kind of a little bit behind the times on, as a matter of fact. So if you can chip in. Well, oh, now it's a whole thing, Max.
Yeah, sorry.
So that's a really great cause, and if we can chip in a couple bucks today for that, we would really appreciate it.
And if you live in a bigger city, there's probably a local bail fund too, although they've been flooded with donations recently. I think a lot of them have asked to donate to other causes now, but those there are a bunch of local ones.
Interesting.
Okay. I have posted to the chat the link. I posted the wrong link first. Sorry, everyone. But posted the correct link there to the chat just now. So you can visit that link and you can donate there. And it's got our stream embedded, so if you're watching the stream, you can watch it there if you like. The bar up top will update as donations come in, so hopefully one of us will notice if it someone kindly donates, and we'll give you a shout-out.
It'll be challenging if donations come in during the show, Bacall, because we'll get distracted. We'll have to pay attention to that. So maybe if people want to gag us during the show, that'll be an interesting challenge for us to deal with. So yeah.
Put the hardest stuff for us to read up there as the name.
You know, for the software I run to run the show, there's a lot of things on my screen, including the actual show, but that takes maybe a quarter of the screen. So that text is pretty small on my screen. Okay. Anyway, let's get on with our discussion. So I invited Max to co-host, and I thought it would be interesting to discuss Dungeon Crawl Classics. So why Dungeon Crawl Classics? I have my my copy here. Dungeon Crawl Classics is old school or OSR RPG. It's the first one I feel like that wasn't like pure retro clone, but really trying to put its own spin, right? It's sort of kind of BX D&D-ish, but then adds a whole lot of stuff. It's also probably about the largest RPG book on my shelf. I think it clocks in at like 480 pages. That's kind of madness for me. I have a weird relationship with this RPG because I kind of love it and I kind of hate it. And
Same.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. Great. yeah.
Dan's has a much slimmer copy. Yeah.
Great. William S. is the one with the extra weird dice. Yes, it has extra weird dice. I've got some of them right here.
Yes.
Yep.
Why
nothing triggers Dan more than these dice.
Here's my nice D24.
Really? You had to bring that up now. You had to bring it up out of the box. Yep. That's the first thing.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Here's a D16.
Here's a seven-sided die. It's a seven-sided die. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty weird. Pretty weird.
Yeah. I think
the table when they come up, I literally start barking. When Max brings out the D7 or
really,
whatever,
it's incredible. D16, yeah.
I literally actually start barking at it because I'm so angry about non-compliant dice.
All right. Before
I just went over the D10, man. I'm just barely comfortable with D10s. Never mind this garbage. Holy smokes.
Oh, jeez. All right. But before we go too far off the deep end, let's give a little background, a personal background with this game and why I asked Max to come in and talk about it. Personally, I've played this at a bunch of conventions, and I've run it at a couple of conventions. It's actually pretty popular at Total Con. So a lot of the times when I'm a player at Total Con, I'm playing DCC, which I really enjoy, frankly. And I've got to play some games run by Michael Curtis there. I've got to play some games run by Tim DeShane. Yep. Of course, as soon as I try to say names on air, they're gone. played some great games. I've run it at a couple conventions myself, and then realized, I can't run this one. Now, Max, you've run a full campaign of it, right?
Yeah. Dan was a player in that. We played for 2 years every other week, I think pretty consistently.
That's great.
Which is maybe the longest time I've used a single system in a row. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it was really great. And really just out of the box, let me just say, Max does a great job, and it was an awesome campaign. We were super happy to have you run that.
That's what you got to say as the guest star now. over that long period of time, you really get the nitty gritty details of the system. What I like it maybe because it's one of the first like retro clone that wasn't really a clone. I realized going through it again, which I hadn't noticed the first time I read through the book, is it's got a list of like how this might be different from, you know, systems you're familiar with. And so it's got bullet points for if you're familiar with 3.5 or 5th edition or AD&D, and not a single one of those bullet points is anything about the meaningful changes in the game. None of them are even close to the strange things in this version.
Interesting.
So at its core, I think the game it's most like at its core, if you ignore all the weird stuff for me, is in fact BX, right? It does do races class, right? It does have the classic, you know, seven fighter, magic user, cleric, thief, dwarf, elf, halfling, right? And then has a lot of, you know, your descending ACs and, you know, and a lot of stuff that's very reminiscent of BX. But then it just plugs in a ton of weird things.
Yeah.
So I don't know. What's the weirdest? What's the weirdest thing it plugs in?
I definitely the most interesting, at least, is the magic. The reason the book is 400 pages is I think most of this is the spell list.
Right.
I think. Yeah, I think like
and each spell is probably spell. Full page. Right. Each individual spell probably takes an entire page at least of text.
Yeah,
it's sometimes multiple. Oh, geez, I just randomly flipped to level 2 wizard staff, which is in fact 3 pages long.
Yeah.
Why are these spells so long?
So each the spells are the book loves tables. There are a lot of tables, and each spell is its own table. So instead of just casting the spell and you get one effect, you roll your casting dice, which I think can be one of the funky dice. So you can be rolling a D24 or whatever. And then the value you get on that chart is the effect the spell has, which if you roll low enough is nothing. You lose it and get nothing. But if you roll 30 plus, it does some crazy extra effect.
And here's a weird thing, right? Like, so it's weirdly walking the line between spells as skills and memorized spells, right? Because, you can cast them as much as you want because you can roll the dice. But one of the negative effects is you can no longer access this spell today.
Right.
If you roll poorly. So it's like memorized spell slots, sort of.
It's pretty weird, and if you it's kind of funny to see a real old school spell if you succeed at it, what it's like if you could cast that say 15 times a day. I think Dan's character was a wizard and at one point just let off a stream of 7 charm person spells, is something to see. That's something to witness.
That's funny. So no, my major memory of this actually is being at TotalCon in Tim DeShane's game where Dan and Ian McGarty were playing wizards and they got into a bit of a wizard's duel trying to one-up each other. And I believe Ian actually like nuked all his spells, like just ran out of ability to cast spells. And so resorted to like trying to hide his crossbow behind his cloak. And casting Bolt of Wood. Which is delightful.
Now, remind me actually on the class thing, because so the long-running character that I had was a halfling who was a sorcerer. How does that... So the thing I've got on my tablet is just the beta rules. So maybe we were playing with some... Like, how did I actually have a halfling who was also a sorcerer? Because I don't see that in the beta rules anymore.
That's because I house ruled it to do a race class split.
Interesting. Okay.
I didn't like the way the races classes were written in this one, and so I house ruled it in probably not a very balanced or exciting manner.
We had halfling wizard. How early did you do that, Max? Did you run some DCC prior to making that choice, or had you just been a player and then decided you wanted that house rule?
Yeah, I was a player. At least in a con game for it, But everybody in that was a human, I think. It never even came up. So I don't know what the deal with that was. But yeah, I just didn't like it. Just from reading it, at least the elf, I think, was interesting. But then the halfling and the dwarf just seemed like slightly more boring fighters and thieves. And so I wanted to keep the extra races in because I think it's kind of a fun, you know, part of it. But they didn't seem like interesting classes to play. But no, I never actually tried it, so I could be wrong.
Yeah, I know they did try to put stuff in there for those classes. Like, the big thing I know with Halfling by the Book is dual weapon fighting and a lot of luck usage.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so...
Right, so they have this whole luck mechanic, right? Which is,
right. Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting, because I noticed just the other day that 5th edition D&D has a special luck mechanic for Halflings. Right? It's not exactly the same mechanic.
Really?
The same thematic, yeah. Yeah. Is that new to 5th edition? I don't know if that was in 4th edition or not. Interesting.
I couldn't say if that's in 4th or not. I don't think it is. But that is something I feel like that comes up a lot when I'm playing 5th, is that stinking halfling luck of like, I rolled a one. Halfling luck. Reroll it.
Wow.
It has the scent of being taken from DCC for me. I bet that's where they took that from.
Honestly, there's another DCC 5th edition crossover, or maybe it's 4th edition crossover, that I find fascinating. DCC is the first game I played that had a sort of magic user class where you also had some kind of powerful supernatural patron who's providing your, you know, not quite a cleric, it's not coming from a god, it's maybe Cthulhu, or it's maybe some more powerful thing. And I thought this was like amazing, not seeing this in other RPGs, and now I'm realizing it's totally the warlock, right? It's 5th edition warlock, which I think was also 4th edition had warlocks. So
yes,
did they take it from 4th or 5th? Which came first? I don't know, but I find that really fascinating.
Ash is confirming that the luck for halflings is new in 5th edition. So thank you to Ash.
Oh, great. Did you guys play with patrons? Did you have anybody with patrons?
That never came up. Although I think I tried to lay moments for the wizards to have patron binding, but whatever is whatever they call it. I realize now, which I just realized this morning, the way it probably comes up most naturally is that the elf class gets a patron as one of their class features. And so by removing that, I think I probably axed it from the very beginning of the game.
I feel that you're totally, your criticism is absolutely right. If we're talking BX, right? If you're talking BX, dwarf is just like another kind of fighter. And so is halfling, frankly. the funny thing is, you know, I was a big BX fan for a long time and I ran BX as is for a while. And then eventually also house ruled a race class split. This is in the time when Dan was running OD&D and I was running BX, and slowly we house ruled towards this unified accidental unified system. And so we talked about race class split and certainly multiclassing quite a lot. I'm not surprised that you would go that road and that you would decide to do a race class split, but I will point out that DCC does a lot of things, adds a lot of stuff. They just add a lot of stuff, let's be honest. But they add a lot of stuff to dwarves and elves and halflings to try and make them distinct.
See, the thing that I didn't like is that, so even that halfling luck mechanic in DCC is actually a thief mechanic that is then copied over and slightly changed for the halfling. I do now regret not having... Yeah,
There's two things. Is the halfling can loan luck to other people.
That's right.
Luck. So best of all worlds, you've got a halfling who's a thief who can loan and regenerate their luck. So it's kind of the two halves of it.
Yeah, I think that halfling also has a kind of a ranger-esque ability to dual wield, right? Isn't there something special about halflings dual wielding?
They have bonuses to two weapon fighting. Dan wouldn't know anything about that because two weapon fighting inherently has to use the funky dice.
Yes, which, by default, D16s.
So I have here a D16. This is a die that will never stop rolling. This is actually just a perfect sphere. It will never show a sign of the die. It will roll off the table and across the room.
That's interesting. My D16 looks like a D10. It's just got D10.
The dual wielding, I think, is kind of... I think that's indicative of a lot of the mechanics in the game, that it's kind of cool that they have rules for it, but it's... I find it too cumbersome. You got to know, you have all these die chain things, and then there are, regular plus and minuses to rolls, and it becomes very hard to for someone to keep in their head what their actual roll is.
I'm seeing here, I'm reading the Halfling 2 weapon fighting, and it's on a D16, and there's a special extra rule for if you roll a natural 16.
Yeah, you know.
Great. Let me praise one thing about this before we pick on it some more. The art in this book is phenomenal.
The art in this book is phenomenal. Yeah.
And at 480 pages, you get a lot of it. So I got it. I got nothing bad to say about that. The art is wonderful.
You know, it's interesting because so DCC will be 10 years old next year, I'm just leafing through this. I was just going to say the same thing. I love the art here, but you know, it's very different than most art you see related to D&D nowadays. It is this very brutalist style of. The people are frail and they're in terrible peril, or they're being destroyed, or they're being, their bodies are being mangled. And there's a lot of like horrific stuff in it. And I feel like nowadays, like the major, like, you know, D&D 5th edition from Wizards, the majority of it is kind of a cartoon anime type style, if I'm not incorrect, right? Mm-hmm. So nowadays I'm used to seeing a whole lot of cartoony type things. And the DCC art is kind of striking me today as like, wow, the exact opposite of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe I'm an old schooler, or maybe something like maybe from the DM perspective, this is what I expect to see more than highlighted, pretty washed up, scrubbed up player characters being highlighted. The art has really changed in the last 10 years of what you normally see for D&D type stuff.
Ash is calling out here the wizard mutation evolution, which I literally have my finger in, right? I was just
incredible.
Just sort of progression of a wizard, and you can see him go from like,
that
apprentice
is so
to
good.
Like horrible mutant. What I was going to say is, like, I guess it shouldn't come as a surprise that Max and I, playing this Warhammer-inspired old-school game, 10 Dead Rats, would love this stuff, right? Like, this is, this is 100% of the feel of what 10 Dead Rats is going for.
You know, I love the piece of art. So at least on the beta rules, the inside cover has this piece of these tusked monsters. Is that by Mullen, like right next to the introduction is what I have that? And it takes me, and it took me a long, and it's interesting because it's structured in a way that it took me a ridiculously long amount of time to realize that they're giants. It has this perspective, right? It has this perspective that's focused on the whole bunch of giants. So normally when I see illustrations with giants, they're like, they're up and they're looming over the perspective frame. But this is at the eye level of the giants, and I've looked at it like 5, 6, 7, 8 times before I realized that they're giants and they have a whole lot of captured, enslaved normal people way down at the bottom of the frame. It's just they're just in the bottom inch of the frame, and it took me a long time to figure out that that's what I was looking at.
And maybe I guess this is different in the beta book because I'm not seeing.
That that's not, or at least it's somewhere else. Yeah,
or they moved it somewhere else.
What's
and I'm not going to flip through 480 pages to find it. Kudos to them on
this.
Let me dig into funny.
So there's here. So I was looking at this. Oh, there's monsters, and it's like, oh, here's people. There's people way down at the bottom, right down here. These are people.
That's funny.
I thought that was great. Anyway, and plus 100 other wonderful things in that book.
Yeah. A lot of great art. Let me pick on another rule that I just don't know what to do with it, honestly, because I love it and hate it, which is the fighter mechanic for what do they call it? The special moves that fighters can
mighty
do.
Deeds of arms.
Mighty deeds of arms. Mighty deeds of arms. Yeah. So clearly they were just trying to give fighters an extra thing, right? Like, that's not too uncommon. OED has fighter feats. Yep. Fighters need another thing. The problem I have with Mighty Deed of Arms is basically it allows the fighter to get a little bonus by describing some interesting action they're taking, right? And so anything from, you know, called shot to I swing from the chandelier or whatever, all this kind of like out there stuff. And I love that the game encourages that, and I hate that it pigeonholes it into this one mechanic for fighters. Like, this is a thing I want all my players to do all the time, right? And I will give you bonuses. If you describe some crazy, ridiculous, out-of-left-field thing that you want your character to do that has no real rule, I will make up rules on the spot, and I will give you bonuses to do it, because I want that in my game. And so... yeah, so I feel really torn about this. Like, is it good that they put it in fighters this way, or is it bad? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it's cool that it's trying to do. I think it sort of feels like it's trying to do feats without actually having a list of feats that you have to like pick from. I think what I kind of feel like this might be a mechanic that's like good for some groups and not great for others. My big problem with it is that because it's this extra bonus that you technically can do on every attack, at least when I was playing, the players playing fighters just felt like every attack they really better come up with something, otherwise they're just wasting this.
Or otherwise
and then
you're
it
not
really
getting
the
bonus.
Becomes, then it really weighs it down. It's like, oh, well, I don't have anything interesting to do here, but I feel like I need to make use of this ability.
It's sort of like systems like, say, Savage Worlds and bennies, right? Where you're like, you're encouraged to give out bennies for players who do clever, interesting, good roleplay things. And I love incentivizing those kinds of actions, but then I feel terrible for the players who just didn't find an opportunity, right?
Yeah. I can also see, like, in certain groups, you know, someone trying to tactically optimize that, come up, like, come to an agreement about what the minimal thing is for creativity and then just do that round after round after round. Right, guys? Sweep a leg. I sweep a leg. And then having determined that qualifies for the bonus, do that every round or something like that. And so the DM would have to manage, like, well, does it have to be like different every round or something like that?
Yeah, that's a tough call. I'm not sure what the answer is, because frankly, even the way I described running it myself of just like, I will give you a bonus. Well, now all my players know, oh, I can get a bonus. I better do weird shit every round. No, that's not the point.
Right.
I think it's something that like some groups probably really enjoy and get a lot of value out of it. My idea on house ruling that was to make it like a you can do this X times a day and maybe find a way to make it more mechanically beneficial so that it feels like a resource you're managing as opposed to desperately trying to come up with a sweep the leg every round of combat.
It's interesting. And then it turns into more record keeping and then it's like... Plus it's got crazy dice involved. Plus it's got crazy dice involved. Yeah. So right off the bat, it's like it's really not a great idea.
Now, happily, you start off rolling a D3, which is a pretty normal die, and fortunately I did get an actual D3. But as soon as you get to third level, you get to use the much more exciting D5. I don't think Dan played
it. I
was watching this garbage happening.
Yeah,
I love how there are clearly different manufacturers of these weirdo dice that have just taken totally different directions.
Totally, yeah, yeah.
Show me your D5 again, Max, because I think it looks radically different from my D5.
My D5 is a 4-sided die with the numbers written in different spots, is really what it is.
Weird. Yeah. That's super weird. My D5 is a D10 with 1 through 5 on it twice.
Ah, that's much nicer, yeah.
That is much nicer, yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I know,
well, you can see Max has these totally non-platonic, like mind-bending, I look at it and I'm like, I'm not sure that should even exist in three-dimensional space, frankly.
It's funny. Go on. I was going to mock the US more. Go on.
Yeah, the thing
we
that,
should make time for that.
Why do we hate these guys so much, though? Why do we hate them so much?
It's impossible.
Right? Like, it seems very reasonable to want to fill the gap between D10 and D20, right? Like, every die type goes up by two maximum value, right? From 4 to 6 to 8 to 10. Don't you want... And 12. Sorry. Don't you want a 14 and a 18?
So we're at risk of honestly going on an hour-long diatribe about this, right? It lacks symmetry, right? It lacks elegance. It lacks elegance, symmetry, the ability to double check, etc., etc. But from a physical mathematical standpoint, why would you not want platonic solids? They're perfect. They're completely perfect. There's only five of them in three-dimensional space. Why are you not going for the gold standard when you can have caviar and then you have rotten fish eggs instead? Why are you doing that?
Excellent.
So my favorite, just to stop the dice.
Yeah.
You know, roll 20.
Wait. I have one more thing to add for the dice. Yeah. So there's Dave Clarkson runs DCC at TotalCon, and he would often bring sets of dice for people because he assumed his players wouldn't have these crazy dice, which makes sense. And he would hand out sets that were in an egg carton, which was kind of hilarious. And so there was an egg carton, and you'd open it up, and they would just be arranged in size order in the little things, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, right, etc. You know, so they're all there in a line. And one of the clever things about that is, you know, you scoop your die out of the egg carton container, and if you had a bonus or a penalty that was going to go up or down the die line, it was very easy to see, okay, I just put this one back and take this one out, right?
That's cool.
It was this nice physical, you know, representation of the up down dice standard, which I assume is in there, right? DCC has some mechanic where bonuses and penalties just up and make you go up and down the dice sides.
Yeah, so it has both your regular plus or minuses to the rolls, and then at some point switches over, I guess, when the bonus would be so much or whatever, it knocks you up a whole die type, which I think actually hurts your bonus at that point, but it is cool.
I feel like this is something we can say universally about DCC. When it comes down to, do they have X or Y? The answer is yes, both.
Yes.
Yes.
It's like the C++ of role-playing games is what it is.
I mean, there are five or six pages in the book with multiple tables and mechanics for doing wizard duels, like using your spells to counter. I never saw this come up, and I played in a bunch of games, but it's there. If you want to do a wizard duel where the rest of your party cheers you on or whatever, there are bizarre rules for it. There are rules to have your apprentice help you in the duel. I can't even imagine. Oh. Yeah.
I mean, it all sounds like things I want to happen in my game, right? They all sound cool.
Yeah.
All right.
So my favorite piece of art, which also describes my favorite mechanic from the game, which I can't find now, is a bunch of people fighting a single skeleton. They're doing terribly because their weapons are a pitchfork, a rolling pin, and a bag of flour. Right. I think is supposed to, which describes the character funnel or the new character funnel, which is, I think, my favorite mechanic.
The funnel itself is your favorite mechanic.
The funnel is great. I would add the funnel to almost any game.
Describe for folks what the funnel is.
Yeah. So instead of rolling a first level character, you roll 4 0 level characters. They have no class. The most they have is a profession, which is like farmer or jester or whatever, which gives them, excellent. Yes. A really, that's maybe my favorite piece of art from any role-playing book because the skeleton looks so unimpressed.
Dan, who's the artist on that?
Well, it's Jim Holloway, who's mostly known for Paranoia, right?
Yep. I recognize his style immediately.
It's very paranoid.
Yeah. That's great.
So
that's
your zero level character has one item from their old profession, a makeshift weapon, and like 1d4 hit points. And you get four of them with the expectation that they will die, that they're so crappy, they couldn't stand up to even the most basic of monsters, and so most of them will die, and the one surviving one becomes your actual player character and gets to become a wizard or a fighter. And it's just a really cool way to get through. If you're doing random dice roll on stats, maybe you're going to roll some really crappy characters, and instead of having to play just that character and, well, now they're going to die because they never had a chance, you just get to run through that very quickly.
It's a clever way. It's a pretty clever way of communicating the old school. You're going to lose a whole lot of characters, right? And to prepare people up ahead that clearly this is going to happen. Just as soon as you start playing the game, you've already been communicated. Actually, having pointed out Jim Holloway art, it's very paranoia-esque. Actually, you make a click of technically six PC clones all at once, and you know you're going to lose a whole bunch of them. So it's pretty clever. I do have one counter argument, but feel free to praise the funnel more before I say I share that.
I did a variant of the funnel once at a convention game where I printed out on just like on index card sized, you know, all the zero level characters for a group of like, I can't remember how many people we had, but it was a big group. Let's say eight. Right.
I think I played this game. I think it was
so eight, I had 32 characters, right? And I was like, okay, here they all are. And there was a big stack of them. And I just put them in a big heap in the center of the table. And I said, these are all the characters. Pull one out of the heap. Play it. When it dies, you can pull another one out of the heap. That way it was just sort of like, I was trying to push that notion of like, this is a big group of people running around. You got like 32 people running around doing this thing. And occasionally one of them steps up and does some cool stuff. And maybe they survive and become a hero. And maybe they die and then we get the next one. Did it work the way I envisioned? I feel like some players at the table were trying to game it a little. And so it fell a little flat.
So William has a good question in the chat of like, when you get out of the funnel, how does the real class get selected?
Yeah, so you just get to... So some of the random professions on the table that you can roll when you're creating the zero-level character are dwarven miner or elven glassblower. And so those ones, it says you're required to then go into the dwarf or elf or halfling class. But otherwise, you just pick from the wizard, cleric, thief, fighter, and you can just pick whatever you want.
That's just like as soon as you get enough XP to get to first level.
As soon as you hit first level, yeah. Although, so this is something I messed up in our game, which led to a very different campaign for a very long time, actually. You're only supposed to pick one, even if you have multiple characters survive. One is supposed to continue on as the adventurer, and the other ones decide it isn't for them, even if they lived and they go home. I let every surviving character become an actual one. Right. And Dan, the power gamer, I think had a full four surviving characters. Every single one of his characters survived, I think.
I had three.
Okay.
Yeah, I did have three. Yeah.
That's great.
And Dan was running three characters compared to most other people's one.
Well, as we know, Dan just loves to run multiple characters. That's a classic Dan Collins move right there.
my instincts from being DM is like, why, like if I have any less than 40 personas that I'm juggling, I'm like, but you know, the funny thing is that the funnel for me the effect for me actually in that game, and I don't think that anybody else was cognizant of it, was that it worked in the reverse for me. Is that the one character that I lost was actually the best? Is like, so I rolled up four, right? And I had one who had like, I don't know, 15 strength, 16 constitution, pretty good dexterity. And the way that I was playing it is that I put that guy in the lead in an attempt to protect everybody else. And then at some point, we were fighting a spider or something like that. He's actually the one that took the hit, went down, and got lost. And then as a result, I saved the entire rest of the group instead of it actually funneling the best guy. So I suppose, and actually, if I'd known about that in advance, and if the player was coldly strategic, then they would actually use the weaker characters as a buffer and to save the strong one actually that's going to get out of the funnel.
And I think that's exactly the problem with the funnel, is that exactly that happens, right? Is that players who are trying to, you know, play the game and realize I have these four characters and this is the one I like and want to survive, will then use the others as meat shields, you know, to let that character get through, which I feel like is a little counter to the intent of the system.
Right. That's
It's a problem with giving you all of them all at once, right? Yeah. It's clever to try to get through it, but on the other hand, that is the little bit of a side effect you get from giving them all at once.
And to be fair, that's what I think I was trying to solve by having a big heap in the middle, right? I was like, you only have one, and then when that person dies, you pull another one from the heap. But then, just because it was a big group of players, and it was a little chaotic, I lost control a little bit, and some of the players were then like grabbing a couple, right, and sifting through them, and finding ones they liked, and hanging on to two, and. Yeah, it got messy.
I wonder if this is like, again, just a what group it works for thing, but I kind of like the idea that at least if the players are embracing it, that maybe your best guy does die. That sucks. Now you're stuck playing this really crappy guy who came in with a chicken and he's the hero now. That's just, you know, oops. I like a lot of the early stories that developed of like how this group of really incompetent people managed to survive after losing their only quality party member.
this has been my experience running D&D, you know, which you can see in effect on 10 Dead Rats, right? Fury has said from day one that she's like waiting for Trebbiano to die so that she can make a new character because Trebbiano sucks. Like those stats are just terrible.
Yeah.
And this happened in my regular D&D campaign as well. I had a player who was playing a fighter who just had terrible stats, and he said, well, I'm going to play the game super risky. I'm just going to run out there and be in the front all the time. And in the first fight, he got his arm torn off. So now he's not only got terrible stats, but he's also only got one arm. And he's like, well, I'm definitely going to die. That is the longest lived character in my campaign.
Of course.
He did repeatedly, just the dice loved him, and he did really well and became this pillar of the game. Much to the chagrin of the player, but then you know, at some point he started to like it and be like, "This is amazing! I have this ridiculous art. What a fighter!"
And I got to admit, right, the longest running player character I ever had was my character Haragar, who started out in second edition as a cleric with one hit point, and of course there was a little bit of a buffer because you can have negative hit points before you die. But the gag was he literally had no consciousness of ever being injured. He had no knowledge of ever having suffered physical injury ever in his entire life because he's either 100% perfectly fine or he's down and he's unconscious immediately. And so he's entirely fearless. He just has no fear whatsoever with one hit point. He would just charge into anything and somehow manage to survive enough that he actually did become durable much, much, much later.
I seem to recall one of my favorite things from you playing that character was that you had this terrible con penalty, right? But there's a rule that like every time you level, you have to gain at least one hit point. So you would level up and roll the dice and do the subtraction and be like, oh, I get the one. I win. I broke the system. Cheated it again. Should get negative two hit points. Get one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I think DCC has a lot of, for all the weird and somewhat cumbersome mechanics, it really lends towards fun, random happenings during the game that then drive the story of the game. The thing I don't think we've mentioned is that the cleric has a different casting mechanic. The cleric's spells they do roll on a table, but they never lose them. But every time they fail to cast them, their god disapproves of them more. And it increases their chance of critically failing. And when they critically fail, their god then demands some penance from them. Mm-hmm, and that penance has a table of really crazy and interesting stuff. And I think a lot of the stuff that happened in our game was based on clerics requiring penance.
That's great.
And I actually, stuff that, like that.
Now that you remind me about that, that actually, I'm full of glee. Actually, over I hadn't thought about that in a while, but you're right, Max. Actually, that I, just thinking about that does actually fill me with a whole lot of joy over that, those things happening. Although there were a lot of times when we needed a heal, like we needed a curing spell because someone was down and about to expire, and there were like real nail biting moments where the two clerics in the party go around for a round, and boy, we were really hoping they wouldn't blow those rolls to see if they clear properly.
Yeah.
Those are real tense moments.
And so did they ever spell burn? Because there's another mechanic in there.
Another mechanic. I think Dan might have been the only wizard at some point, and so I think did occasionally do spell burn. But was also a halfling wizard, and I might have been allowing luck to be spent on spellcast too. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't. The truth is, I actually reserved my. I think I could have, but I actually always reserved my luck points for other players. So I was trying to be a team. And I would actually never spend luck on myself. I would always make sure it was available for other people all the time.
Yeah. So by the book. Mechanically, and I've only ever seen this happen at convention games, is a wizard can spend other attributes, can like decrease their strength and constitution and basically feed their body into the spell to make it go off, which is clever and thematic, right? Makes I get where you're going from, but oh man, I can't imagine in a campaign a player being willing to spend to burn down their strength or constitution into a one-off event like that.
In a con game I played in, at the last fight, one of the wizards burnt all but one point of their strength. Because you have this roll, this chart that you're rolling on, and the higher you get on the chart, the better the effect of your spell is, to the point that it can become this ridiculous thing if you can hit over 30. And so in the boss fight, he just burnt all but one of his strength to guarantee that he'd hit the top level entry on the chart, and it was really cool. Again, right, it only is for a con game because he's never going to play this now.
Yeah,
bone yeah, in, unable to pick up a fork right. Wizard. But
that, again, it sounds to me like a thing that could then drive your campaign, right? Like, now we need to go on a quest to, like, restore the physical attributes of this wizard who, like, gave himself to pull off this thing, right?
Yeah.
I guess I'm curious, Max, can you go into that a little bit more? Like, how were you running modules? Were you running your own stuff? How often did you have to like go off and invent whole new stuff because the players did some crazy thing?
So I was running all my own stuff, and I'm a terrible planner, so I almost always improv an unreasonable portion of the games. And it was a lot of in my memory, at least maybe the most distinctive parts were the stuff that were driven by crazy things happening to the players. A lot of stuff was driven by the fact that one of our clerics, when he got disapproval, would constantly hit the entry that his god demanded he convert X number of people to his religion, but there weren't any people because they were in a dungeon, so he had to figure out how to convert kobolds and captured orcs to his ridiculous made-up religion. And that religion gradually grew to be the most prominent religion in the area because of how many people he was forced to convert. And that was that's maybe my most distinct memory of the game, and a lot of driven by, well, we're now missionaries.
Right.
That was great.
Yeah, that's really great. I mean, for a similar thing in D&D, honestly, this is the carousing table does a lot of this for me.
Yeah.
Right. The most memorable crazy things in my long running D&D campaign were born of terrible things happening in the carousing table and the players trying to get around that.
Yeah.
Although honestly, the biggest driver in my campaign ever was the quest for limb restoration. Because I had house ruled in a critical hits chart that had the tendency to occasionally take off limbs and overlooked the fact that there is no magic by the book that will restore that. And so they've already had to go out and quest for it. And man, like years, they spent years, literal years, hunting for a way to restore those lost limbs.
So DCC, of course, also has crazy critical hit table. Not only does it have a crazy critical, it has multiple critical hit tables. You have a different critical hit table based on your class. And if you're a fighter, you get increasingly more dangerous critical hit tables you get to roll on. which the monsters also roll on. So, yeah. I mean, if you love tables, this is absolutely the game for you.
Yeah. I want to say that, like, the monsters have different criticals based on, like, what kind of weaponry carry, right? Or
vampire or undead monsters have their own critical hit table. Dragons have their own one. Right. It's, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. If you're, here's the thing for me, I think this game really sings when it's run by a DM who just absolutely loves it and has dug through the book 16 times and knows how to get to those tables quickly, right? Knows that they all exist and knows how to get to them quickly. Because that's the problem, right? It's just internalizing all this stuff and being able to get it onto the table fast is really hard. Right, and that's the problem I had running it. It was like, it's just
me,
like,
too.
I don't want to spend half the game flipping through 480 pages.
That's the main. That for me, that's the main barrier to committing to using DCC. And the other thing is that it's the spells that all have their own table. And William there a couple minutes ago said, so basically this is the everyone is second edition Wild Mage of the game. which is observation is that every single spell has either a full page or two page list of about 15 or more entries that you must roll on. They're impossible to memorize. It's just too many. You can't even memorize just what the charm person spell says. So not only the DM but every player who uses spells has got to commit to every single time they cast a spell, looking up that page in the book. Or what several of our role players were doing, use an app on a phone to look it up. So you'd have to have the phone out, you'd have to have the device, look it up. And then occasionally we'd have connection problems, and your connection...
Especially at a convention.
Your connection goes down. Well, now we can't cast any spells because we haven't got any idea what any of them do at that point. So not just with the DM, but the fact that the spells interface with every single player with spells, that every time a spell goes up, you've got to look up on a page to see what that particular effect is.
Which is pros and cons, I think. The pro is that it's kind of fun that the magic is this really crazy, like, even the person casting it is not totally sure what's going to happen. Which, if there were a way to slim down the cumbersome nature of the tables, I think is a really fun... Because the difference in the charts are almost rarely just mechanically increasing, like, oh, you roll more dice and more dice or whatever. Like, the different things in the charts do different stuff, and it's fun to see. But you could never know what's going to happen when you cast charm person. You might not even charm the person.
It is worth pointing out that there is an app actually that's very good. I know certainly that's my experience too, going to conventions and immediately having people around me being like, you gotta have the app out, get the app out. I can't remember. It's like called the Crawler or something like that.
The website I think is called purplesorcerer.com that has them all online.
So I definitely recommend having that handy.
It helps to distribute as many of the tables to the players as possible. I think I eventually printed out the God disapproval table and gave it to the cleric so that the DM is not responsible for all of this, which is how I started, and that is very hard to do.
Yeah, that was a good idea. And actually, Ash is reminding me that not like on top of that, every wizard has a separate individuated side effect or variation on spells, right? Which again is a complicating factor. You got to record that for every single separate spell. But on the other hand, for me, it was the single biggest highlight for me with that character playing the game because we slightly modified it actually at my request. Is that every single time my halfling character cast charm person, he/she would transform gender, would switch binary genders back and forth every time, whether it succeeded or failed. So all through every single game session, I was actually transforming my character's gender back and forth, which I hope isn't offensive. I thought that was really interesting, and I appreciated the opportunity to explore that actually, but. So I was personally really, really happy to be able to have that on the table as a thing that was happening for my character.
Interesting.
I think that was cool. I can see how that particular effect might have problems for certain in certain situations, but that was a fun thing. And all of them have weird gimmicks like that about how you cast them.
Yeah.
Just to go back to Max talking about improvising and making stuff up and whatnot. One of the interesting things I think about Dungeon Crawl Classics for me is that I ultimately got into it, A, by playing at conventions, but B, by looking at their modules, right? They've written a boatload of adventures.
Yeah.
And I think that's how they started. I want to say that's how they started. Yes. Originally, they were writing modules for other versions of D&D.
Okay.
And some of those adventures are just amazing. They're just so thematic, right? They're just so full of that same sense of what the game is trying to push without all the mechanics behind it, right? It's just, it sort of reminds me, honestly, of like Lamentations of the Flame Princess in this way of like, I love the content that's built for it, and I could maybe get away with just using the content that's built for it and not the actual system.
Interesting. I don't think I've read any of the anything written for it, but maybe I should. Yeah.
And kind of known for having like gorgeous map art, right? Like that's very typical of their adventures. I will say a lot of them are somewhat linear. When you get to the part that's about the dungeon, they get a little linear, which is unfortunate. But I've run a couple of them, and they're just they're really good. They're really good. So I definitely recommend them.
Yeah, it's interesting because when Goodman Games, so when the D20 system came up with third edition around 2000, Goodman really charged and you had the license for the first time to officially support actual Dungeons and Dragons supplements. Goodman really took the opportunity to charge into that, wrote a whole slew of interesting old school type modules for the third edition era. About 10 years later, as many of us, shifted away from third edition, there was this bifurcation between are you doing third or 3.5 or Pathfinder or going to BX or old school or first edition. That's the same time zone when Joseph Goodman said, well, I'm going to make my own game system here, Dungeon Crawl Classics, kind of to continue supporting this stuff because they were really retracting the licensing rights at the time of fourth edition. And I know that Joseph Goodman really kind of fought and struggled with their much more restrictive license. And his overall goal was really, I want to have stuff that actually has Dungeons and Dragons on the label. And for fourth edition, he kind of couldn't really do that anymore. So after a lot of struggle, that's sort of what put him on the track of making DCC.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, he really wrestled
with that. We are close to our time here. So does anybody have any final thoughts on Dungeon Crawl Classics?
I honestly think it's really worth checking out. I feel like we've both got issues with it. I'm not sure I would run it again outside of a con game, but it is a game I constantly think about how I would house rule it to make it a little more palatable to me, and I think some groups it's going to be like a really good game for them. I honestly think the good parts are really good and worth checking out, particularly the magic and the character funnel.
Dan,
we had a blast with it. We had a real blast with it. It really gave us legs for a long time. Like Max said, about 2 years. It's so big. I mean, is everything going to be perfect? No. But there's a lot of stuff that really put joy into our games that were surprising, and then there's also stuff that was a little bit granular or rough to get around, and there's a lot it's not perfectly ironed out, but there's a lot of really interesting things. I will say that I have a real soft spot for Dungeon Crawl Classics, partly because Joseph Goodman in his Appendix O for online resources referenced my blog, deltasdnd.blogspot.com, as one of the highlight online resources for old school gaming. So once again, big thanks to Mr. Goodman for including me and my blog in the text to Dungeon Crawl Classics.
That's great.
So I'm well disposed to say nice things. Good job.
There you go.
Yeah.
For me, I love playing DCC. If someone's running DCC at a convention, I'm going to play it. Will I run it myself? Probably not. I think I agree with Max here that there's a lot of great pieces in it, and I might dig through the book and steal bits and bobs. Certainly might get some of their adventures, some of the modules, and rerun them in different settings. I don't think I would ever run DCC as is again, but I definitely adore playing it. I adore playing it. So any DM who's willing to put in the effort to master this dense text, I will play in your game. For sure.
It's almost worth, you know, the art alone. Like, if you've got the book and you just leaf through it and you pick up any page, look at it, you could write an adventure around any particular one of the dense, wonderful, old school, horrific illustrations they've got in there. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them from many, many, you know, top artists. And boy, they did a wonderful job with that.
There are even like 10 different cover art variants, and each of them are fantastic. Paul and I both have the same one somehow, but there's like 10 different cover arts.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's the one with indigo on the back.
Ah, yes, that's right. That really is. We got to put that on the 10 Dead Rat stream. That is absolutely spot on. Amazon better be sponsoring the stream if we're going to.
Awesome. All right. Well, if any of our kind viewers have any thoughts on Dungeon Crawl Classics, there's so much to pick apart. There's so many good pieces. There's so many infuriating pieces. You know, leave us a comment. Leave us a comment in the chat below. We would love to hear your thoughts, and maybe we'll spin that up into future conversations.
Definitely. Definitely. So is Max doing this?
I thought Max was
doing
it. Come on, Max.
I'm ready for it.
Right.
Oh, man, does this start at the top? I only had the bottom part
ready
here.
Okay, well, I'll help you out. So what Max is trying to remind people about is that you can like and follow and subscribe to the Wandering DMs on social media sites such as YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and also Facebook. Under the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites, Max. You remember that?
yes, great. And now I'm seeing Paul speaks.
Yes. we're enjoying ourselves too much here. Viewers, at the very beginning of our show, Dan tried to show Max his end of show notes, which Max took a picture of, and I'm sure it's too much. It's too much. If you would, you may also listen to our show in audio-only podcast format. You can find those podcasts at our website, www.wanderingdms.com. We are also carried by various podcast redistributors such as iTunes and Google Podcasts and Spotify and Stitcher and all those places. If you are listening to this podcast on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate it.
I think I got this one. And thanks to our patrons who support the show. And if you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/wanderingdms. We're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. So please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
That was great. Thanks for filling in, Max.
thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.